men have been told over and over in many different ways that who they are is really not needed. You know, there's all these questions about what does it mean to be a man? It's sort of back to the real here, everybody. You've told men that what they are is something you don't want.
Have you ever felt a growing sense of hope in a new day? Like when the dawn light breaks and the world wakes up. We feel that every day because we know that light changes everything. It opens our eyes to possibilities and it propels us forward. Light shows us where we belong. Light is what the world desperately needs. Be light at Franciscan University.
Hey, thanks for joining us today on our Reason for Hope. I just found out the other day from one of our producers that, you know, more than half the people that watch this show, this podcast, do not subscribe to us. This is insane. I mean, what are you waiting for? Hit the subscribe button now. All right, back to the show.
Welcome to today's episode. We're honored to sit down with a scholar whose work is reshaping the contemporary conversation about men, women, and the human person. Dr. Deborah Savage is a leading Catholic theologian and longtime researcher in the field of philosophical anthropology. She joins us to explore the questions that lie at the heart of human identity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And what unique gifts do each bring to the world, the family, and the church? Dr. Savage's path to theology and academia has been anything but conventional. And today she'll share how her rich professional and personal journey ultimately led her to Franciscan University of Steubenville. Her decades-long research into the nature and complementarity of the sexes has become foundation for her latest and perhaps most ambitious project, the newly launched Institute for the Study of Man and Woman at Franciscan University, where she serves as founder and director. In our conversation, Dr. Savage will take us inside the research that has shaped her thinking over many years, walk us through the inspiration behind the Institute, and explain how its mission offers something profoundly new to both the church and to the broader culture. We'll also dig into some essential and deeply timely questions, the so-called crisis of men, the meaning of the feminine and masculine genius, the roles of men and women in the family and in society, and why sound theology must enter into dialogue with the sciences. Finally, we'll explore what all this means for Catholic students, for families striving for stability and holiness, and for everyday believers seeking clarity in a confusing cultural moment. It's a conversation filled with insight, challenge, and hope. So stay with us. Dr. Savage, so good to have you today.
Oh, I'm so honored to be here. I really am.
I really ought to have mentioned in that intro that we've known each other quite a while and that you were very, very essential to my own scholarship when I was working on my doctoral dissertation. And you wrote the foreword to my own book, Healing the Culture and the Family, according to John Paul II, which I'm so grateful for still. So you've had a great influence on me, and I think so highly of you, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
So am I.
So let's start with your story. I mean, you have an unusual career path to this point, you know, and I don't think, like, if you thought of yourself decades ago, you would have imagined you would wind up teaching theology in Steubenville, Ohio. So how did we get here?
Yeah, people ask me, how did you get where you are, you know, especially young women. And I have to say, I actually have no idea. It was definitely God's plan because I didn't plan this, you know. I started out as a factory operator in the semiconductor industry when I was 18. I won't tell you how many decades ago that was. There was a few. That's how I got through college. I put myself through college and my undergraduate degree is in business. So once I graduated, I got a job as a production supervisor, and the rest is sort of history. I moved up the sort of chain of command worked in large corporations, mostly manufacturing organizations, and eventually opened up my own consulting firm. And what led me to the study of philosophy and theology was that along the way I discovered that the so-called Japanese miracle, some of your listeners won't even know about that. It was something that took place in the 70s and 80s, but all of a sudden, it seemed like from one day to the next, people started buying tiny little Japanese cars instead of Ford trucks. And I wanted to understand better how they accomplished that. They went from being completely demolished in World War II to the second largest economy in the world by 1963. And the methods that they learned about actually were taught to by Americans, developed and taught by Americans. So there is a point to this kind of long story. What I discovered, and I guess I was the only one who realized it, that the reason they were successful using those methods was because of their spiritual traditions. There were even management papers written that made this explicit connection, demonstrating that there was a way in which the Confucian virtue ethics that undergird their culture had grounded their ability to be patient, to seek the good always, and, you know, and other virtues that were central to good work. And I thought that was curious. What was there missing? Or was there something missing from our own tradition? What had happened that this, it was clear that the Christian tradition was not informing our work behavior in the same way. So I went to find out the answer. And once I got there, I read Aquinas. I had read him before, and that was all she wrote. So I kind of left. My first questions were in Catholic social thought and the free market, the moral capitalism questions. I still have those. But pretty soon I was in the thralls of Thomistic metaphysics and philosophical realism and all of that. And that's what changed my life. So my first job was teaching philosophy at a seminary. I taught philosophy to the pre-theologians for 13 years. That was definitely something that was not envisioned in my plan, that I would teach at a seminary. And I thought I'd teach business ethics, but there I was. And it was during that time that I began my research into the questions we're talking about here today. Is that enough?
No, that's great. That's great. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Thomistic realism. Of course, you and I have had many conversations about this very topic. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could just explain for our listeners what that is. You know, obviously, they may have some familiarity with St. Thomas Aquinas, but what does it mean that his metaphysics was realistic or a realist? And why is that, I think, if you wouldn't mind just expanding, why is that so instrumental, even in the conversation today about what it means to be a man and a woman, in particular, in a moment when people are not identifying the body personally and subjectively?
Yeah. I'll do my best. One of the things that is illuminating, I think, is what Chesterton says, which is that the philosophy of Aquinas is the philosophy of the man on the street. Because it starts in this, it really all begins in the senses, in contact with the real, like the person, the body, the nature all around us, the bird, the water, the fish. Metaphysics in the modern understanding of it is something that is divorced from the real. It's a speculative endeavor that sort of makes things up a little bit in the head, right? Like Descartes was sitting next to a fire, drinking sherry, while he wrote his meditations, in which he said, "I'm not sure I have a body." as he put more fire on wood on the fire, because it was getting cold in the room, I'm not sure I have a body. That's not Thomistic metaphysics. It's not Aristotelian metaphysics. Aristotle and Aquinas both start with the real world and discern in the real world those universal truths that you can say about everything. Okay, so the reason it's so important is because the church's entire edifice of teachings, all her truth claims, are grounded in this realist metaphysics. We start with what is actually real, knowable through the senses, and go from there. So a curious thing is that the Catholic understanding of the human person and man and woman, since it begins with the facts about them, it actually begins sort of in what the science can reveal even. The Catholic Church is really the only one grounded in the real in all the questions we're debating these days about gender. The church is, funnily enough, the only one with legitimate science at work, right? So curious, so ironic.
So as you were drawn to these questions, particularly questions about man and woman, your study of Aquinas was complemented by the work of John Paul II. And in fact, if I recall correctly, your doctoral dissertation dealt with John Paul II's encyclical on human work. And so talk a little bit about how the insights of John Paul II complemented what you were seeing in Aquinas' metaphysics and how it led you to these questions about the human person and then man and woman, particularly.
Yeah, so I didn't really grasp the full meaning of John Paul II's own anthropology until I was writing my dissertation. I was interested at first in the work of Bernard Lonergan, who was a particular type of Thomist, but he uses similar language to what John Paul II uses in terms of, let's say, the prominent place that lived experience has and other things. Their accounts of the self-transcending subject seemed similar to me, but they're in entirely different schools of Thomism. So I loved Aquinas, and Lonergan was a Thomist, so that was already covered. And I loved John Paul II as Pope. I mean, he was my hero. So my main topic, really, and my main interest was what I ended up calling the conversion of the acting person. Could you be converted through your work that you do in the world? And so I ended up comparing Lonergan and Wojtyła. And I started out a Lonerganian. And as soon as I started to study Wojtyła, my eyes just got bigger and bigger. And he is absolutely a radical philosopher. And I now understand that his work is a synthesis of Thomism and sort of his own brand, let's say, of personalism and phenomenological method. This is very important for everyone to grasp. Carol Wojtyła, JP2, he is not a phenomenologist. He's a Thomist who is reminding everybody that Thomas's work and the definition of the person introduced into the tradition by Boethius, man, the person is an individual substance of a rational nature, simply reduces the human person to what he calls a cosmological reality, someone who exists in the order of creation as a sort of abstraction. And Aquinas's work, developing a metaphysical account of the person, all the powers that we have, our telos, the relationship between the soul and the body, there's no better place to go than Thomas's account of that. But Wojtyła says, hold on a second, everybody, you haven't gone far enough. Leave man on this order of creation where he is. Everything Aquinas says is true. And it laid out the metaphysical terrain, that we've all been benefiting from. But you haven't accounted, not you've accounted for man as a subject of existence, but not as a subject of action. There's an inner dynamism to human subjectivity that needs to be explored. So he argues, and he's absolutely right, that human subjectivity, distinguishable from subjectivism, that's not what he's doing. Right. Human subjectivity is actually an objective reality that can be investigated through reference to the inner life of man and his actions in the world. And I personally think that his anthropology gives us a really solid starting place for the work we need to do in the world to help people understand the meaning of their own experience, even when it's distorted, even when they've decided they understand it and they've concluded all sorts of things about what it means, like, I must be a woman in a man's body. Because that's a metaphysical as well as a physical impossibility. Right. So we've been tricked.
And I also have found myself that approach of John Paul II's is an important evangelical tool.
Oh, yes.
Because what winds up happening is, since people, whether they know it or not, have inherited a way of looking at themselves in the world that comes down to them, let's say from Descartes for the sake of argument, that they're all wrapped up in the workings of their inner world and their consciousness and their own quote-unquote subjectivity, but they can't break out. So everything becomes subjectivism. It becomes what I feel is right, what I think I am is what I am, all those kinds of things, where Thomas's realistic metaphysics is what is almost, in a sense, the interpretive key to our experience and our lived experience. So therefore, it enables us to help people who are stuck in themselves to reconnect with the world as it is and as it was created by the Lord.
So. Yeah, that's excellent. Yes, I think it paves the way to a real encounter with the real. It forces us to recognize that I only know what's true. I only possess the truth about something if what I think is true actually corresponds to what is true. And the determining factor is not what I think is true, but the thing in itself. That's the measure. And in our era, we've just been living under the influence of Protagoras since the 5th century BC, who is the one who said man is the measure of all things. And he's not. That leads to disaster, to the tragedy we're witnessing all over the world, really. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So return to the real is a battle cry these days.
Yeah. I agree. So how did all this turn into your love for the study of man and woman and the importance of that today? Was that because of your encounter with John Paul II as you went further into him? And then your own experience of, let's say, growing up in this world and where the world is at, all coming together. So explain a little bit about how you got led to that, which is, of course, the foundation for this institute.
Sure. Well, I have to say that I was pursuing in a research agenda that had everything to do with a kind of moral capitalism, I suppose, for lack of a better word. I was really interested in human creativity and its ability to create wealth or generate wealth, which seems essential. And then I was talking with my spiritual director, and he said, why are you spending all this time on that? You should be thinking about woman and man. He didn't say man and woman, but around that time, the feminine genius, because this was in the mid-90s, the feminine genius was making its way into the lexicon of the Catholic community. And I was asked to speak about the feminine genius, and I did do that. But my spiritual director said, really, you should really shift gears. And it just penetrated. And I still have that research area. I think it's actually important and relates to the questions we face about man and woman. It's not separate from it, but or it's distinct from it, but not entirely separate. But I was obedient. My spiritual director seemed to be right. And so, okay, so I started to give talks on the feminine genius, but pretty soon I found that distasteful because it seemed to turn into a kind of strange form of Catholic feminism where we would sit around at events, especially if wine was involved, and talk about how stupid our husbands were. And I just said, wait, there's something wrong with this picture. And I said to myself, well, what happened to the masculine genius? Surely there is one. And I remember sitting on my bed one day thinking to myself, you can't really write about that. I mean, you're a girl. And then the thought came to me, I think sent to me from JP2 himself, whom I've been praying to since before he died, I think. John Paul II was a boy and he wrote about me. So I should be able to write about boys and men and to sort that out. So I had already come to some conclusions about what constitutes the feminine genius. And I'm going to end up arguing that both the masculine and feminine genius can be derived from the two accounts of creation. We'll get to that. But I started to press then on the question I had about the masculine genius, and the scripture gave way. It just gave way to me. And I started to ask a lot of questions. I'm not a scripture scholar. And every question I asked about the real meaning of the original Hebrew term turned into another insight or another realization until eventually it's absolutely crystal clear to me that God was revealing through the sacred author his account of man and woman, and it's all tied up in the order in which they are both created. Yeah, so we can come to that. But then I started to write about the masculine genius, and now that's the main thread for me in my work.
Isn't it funny, kind of a funny thing? I was just going to say, and maybe this is just the nature of the culture, you know, that a woman can speak about like the feminine genius and she can get away with it because obviously she's a woman, but a man can't speak about the feminine genius. In fact, John Paul II was ridiculed for trying to say such a thing, even at the time, if you remember how the reaction of the broader society to his letter to women. But a man also can't say anything about masculine genius. Otherwise he looks like he's puffing out his chest.
No, that's right. No, you guys are in the soup there. So I think, what I know and what I offer to the community of men, anybody listening, I can say things about you that you cannot say out loud without criticism. And what I say in all my public remarks in my writing is that what we owe men is a debt of gratitude. Men have sustained civilization since the beginning. Anthony Eslin has a wonderful book on this in which he argues that the strength of men is what has sustained civilization. And he doesn't just mean physical strength. Yeah. So the crisis of men is, I think, actually real. Their data seems to support it, but we better fix it and fix it fast because we need both men and women to fulfill God's plan for us. And the problem is you can't understand woman apart from man or man apart from woman. And so just one other thought about this. In 1995, John Paul II sent out Evangelium Vitae. In paragraph 99, he calls for a new feminism. But many of us thought, okay, I guess that's what we better do. What would a Catholic feminism look like? But I argue in a recent article I published that that's actually a trap. He wasn't not a trap he set, but one he was just saying, in 1995, second wave feminism was on the upsurge. It was, you know, making all sorts of promises that it turned out it couldn't keep. John Paul was simply speaking into the culture. And if you read paragraph 99 in Evangelium Vitae carefully, you see him define it in a way that actually points back to his a decade of work on these questions, which ended in 1989 with his letter on Joseph. After that, he doesn't write about it anymore. From the beginning of his pontificate to 1989, he does a theology of the body. He writes Mulier's Dignitatum in 88. He writes his letter to about Joseph, or Redemptoris Custos, on the anniversary of the promulgation of Mulier's Dignitatum in 1989. And then the next decade, he's on to the social questions. So if you read through those documents, what he says more than once is that the only way women will find their place in the world and in the church, words to that effect, is through a deeper investigation of the anthropological meaning of masculinity and femininity. He says that more than once in those documents. He's signaling to all of us that the only way to get where you want to go, women, is by understanding yourself in relation to man. And so I saw that and I said, you're right. And again, that was all she wrote.
Yeah. Thank God for that spiritual director.
I know.
Hello, and thanks for being with us here on A Reason for Hope podcast. Been very grateful of the many years that we've been doing this for you. This is our sixth season with hundreds of podcasts already released. Although they're free to watch and listen to, they're not free to produce. So I'm asking that you discern to contributing and donate to A Reason for Hope podcast. We're a nonprofit organization. Every dollar, every penny is tax deductible. All you have to do is go to our website and click donation and navigate the podcast. All the funds that you donate will go to the production of this podcast. Thanks again, and may God bless you.
So listen, why don't we just, if you can, just briefly delve into a little bit of these insights. I mean, I don't want to like steal your thunder with work you've got coming out, but I'd love for the audience to hear about particularly how you think in the creation stories of Genesis, how you can see a masculine genius in relation to the feminine. And I think that'd be really wonderful for, I know what you're going to say because I've heard you talk about this, which I think is lovely, but I think that it's got such a broad appeal and it will just be a light bulb going on for people. So if you might share some of that.
Absolutely. First of all, let me preface all of this by saying that I would argue that the use of the term feminine genius by John Paul II was really a rhetorical device. He's pointing to something that everybody knows about. Anybody with a mom knows about the feminine genius, right? But he's a philosopher, and he would know that he has to do more work to ground that in a robust anthropology. What sort of attribute is that, right? I don't need to pursue that. Your listeners would turn us off. But, you know, he would have known there was more work to do with that. So that's one place to start, is what does that actually mean? How does it define the person? Does it define the person, and in what sense? So so the return to scripture was to begin anew this investigation into the source of this genius that women clearly possess. Another preliminary remark I should make is that he says in the Theology of the Body, second and third audiences, he claims that Genesis 1 is about man in the abstract, the Thomistic account, and Genesis 2 is about man in his subjectivity, the personalist account. He makes that claim, but he does not demonstrate it in the Theology of the Body. In the seventh audience, he says, I'm not going to worry about that stuff. So I said, well, that's fine. I'll do it. and I wanted to see if you could really make that claim. So my work has been to unpack that, to ask that question, to persistently say, is that really legitimate? Was he trying to get away with something there? Or is it really true? And I have discovered I can demonstrate that he's right. Because the first account of Genesis demonstrates without question that the Semitic author, when he uses the word Adam, he meant, at least in the terms that the Semitic language would allow, man in the abstract. Adam stands for man in the collective sense in the Hebrew language, which is equivalent to our man in the abstract, man per se, etc. Okay, there's much more we could say about that. But the subjectivity of man and woman, which appears in the second account, you really have to trace the order in which both of them appear, right? So the account begins by recognizing that there is a hierarchy in the God's act of creation that emerges as you go through both accounts. God first creates the sky and the land and then the waters. And I can't remember all the things, but sea monsters are in there somewhere, right? And there's a gradual evolution. I don't mean that in any Darwinian sense, but there's a gradual progression of the created order from sort of lower things, things outside of man, to higher things. So it all culminates in the creation of man and woman, male and female, he created them. The second account also has a similar progression. Adam is made from the earth, but woman is made from man. Alice von Hildebrand has a funny saying, and she says, would you rather be made of mud or would you rather be made of Adam's rib? And I agree with that. The woman is made from a material that is already in act, already has a degree of actualization, and that's really important. But the whole point is that woman is not created second. She's created last and on the way up. Okay? And it, further demonstration of this is the word for helper in Hebrew is azer, and that means divine aid. It most definitely does not mean scullery maid, right? Or servant in the usual sense. Like, we're all servants of each other, of course, but she's not a housekeeper. She's divine aid. Woman is sent to man in order to help man to live. But the interesting thing is that the Semitic author adds to that. It's not just azer, it's azer kenegdo. And kenegdo is a preposition that means in front of, in the spatial sense. So why would this author add to a beautiful account a meaningless preposition if he didn't intend something? And kenegdo means that Adam and Eve, man and woman, are literally face to face in the created order. And because woman comes out of Adam's rib, you can say that without man, woman has no place. He gives her a place. But you can also say, and this is my addition to the story, without woman, man has no future. So it's only when woman appears that Adam even knows who he is and what he's there for. At Genesis 2:15, God has told him, till the garden and keep it. And you can kind of picture Adam saying, for all of eternity, God, you're the boss, but no problem, but sure. Every day
or,
I just...
Or why? Well, why should I do that?
Yeah, right.
For what?
Yeah, every day I just come out and weed the garden? Okay. But when woman appears and he says, oh, here at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, he knows who he is in her gaze. She reveals him to himself in a certain way. And it's only with the appearance of woman that human community appears in human history. Woman makes self-gift possible, right? And he reveals to Adam his telos. Oh, I see. the gifts, the skills, the talents, the gifts I have are to be put in the service of her. And now I understand why I am here. And so my argument is that the feminine genius itself is apparent in this, the order in which man and woman are created, because man is in the garden alone for some period of time. It's clear from the scripture. He's given dominion over all the things. He's given the task of naming everything in nature, right? Aquinas argues he must have had a distinct preternatural gift to be able to do that, to see into the nature of things. And I argue that the masculine genius, maybe I should just start there, is found right there, well known in the science. Social science, neuroscience illuminates the fact that men are more object-oriented. Little boys will drop everything and go unpack boxes of toys when they arrive at the door of a preschool. Little girls will drop everything when new kids arrive. The boys will just say, whatever, come join us if you want. So there's all sorts of evidence that men are more object-oriented. And it's clear from history that men have command over the created order that has permitted civilizations to survive. Okay. So I say the masculine genius is connected to this reality visible in the creation of man and woman that reveals him to be an expert on creation. He knows what it is. He knows what it's for. And he's created systems that allow him to decipher what can be predicated of it and how to distinguish things and things like that. So, but when you look at woman has never lived in a created order not already inhabited by persons. The first thing that she sees is Adam's face. The created things of the world, the lions, tigers, and bears, they're all on the periphery of her gaze. But woman is, when Adam's first encounter with reality is of loneliness, of the things that don't match him, woman's first encounter of reality is of a world inhabited already by persons. So I say that's the start of the feminine genius. Woman is the mother. Eve is the mother of all mankind. In that moment, she's made the mother responsible for all mankind, not just the women, but the men and the women. That's her task. And it's because she has this capacity to see into the potential of others and to call it out of them, to remind us in her gaze, if she's really fulfilling her mission, to remind us all of who we really are. Yeah, there's a beautiful Talmudic tradition that has to do with the Shekinah, which is the divine presence. It's not God. It's the presence. It's considered a sort of feminine reality. And that notion is what allows us to argue that Mary is a tabernacle. And my argument would be that woman's task, no matter what kind of job she has, is to carry the divine presence into the world. And I'll stop there.
No, that's great. You could imagine in this context certain things that we may in a fallen post, you know, in a post-fallen state have as struggles. Like, for example, if men are naturally inclined towards the object, right, as opposed to the person, it might very well be man's nature. And we can see this, I think, in Genesis chapter 3, that, you can see in man's nature the tendency to turn the woman into an object, right?
Well,
as opposed
right.
to a person.
That's right.
So
yeah.
so it becomes the gift actually becomes the obstacle after the fall.
No,
right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I argue and I've written about this. You can't really understand what goes on in the fall unless you first have it clear what's really going on when they're created. The gifts that they're given are literally turned upside down in the fall, right? I want to stress that man's orientation toward things does not mean he's disordered. When woman, or that he doesn't understand the importance of persons, because the evidence is right there. He recognizes that woman is not an object like the rest of the things of creation. He recognizes an equal like himself, and that he cannot dominate her as he does the lions, tigers, and bears. That's what he loses. That vision is what he loses in the fall, where he's told that he will now have to labor the sweat of his brow, etc. So his command or his dominion over creation is now compromised. Anyway, now he has to struggle, and as you say, he begins to treat everything as an object, including woman. And it's important to realize that this is verified by God's description of what the woman will suffer now. She was an expert on relationships, right? Let's say a kind of shorthand. But now her desire will be for her husband, even though she knows he seeks to dominate her. Mm. So in that sentence, you see both gifts have been turned upside down. And what I see, sort of like being able to see like an x-ray vision or something, I can see that we are replaying that moment in the garden again and again and again, and have been for centuries, because we don't understand each other. But Jesus came to save us. Jesus came to reveal us to ourselves. And John Paul's instruction that we return to the beginning in the theology of the body, begin there, really gives us a starting place in trying to unpack the meaning of these two creatures and what their mission is in the world.
Well, you had mentioned when we had discussed the Institute that one of the things that you wanted to do with the Institute that is somewhat unique is to focus on this crisis of men, and in particular, to look at the situation of men in the world today. So maybe there's other things too, of course, but maybe you can speak to that a little bit. Like you say that this is playing itself out over and over again, and we can see it in a unique way today. So what's your read on that crisis of men in the world today and the importance of reclaiming this idea of a masculine genius so that men can find their way? Because I could tell you, I teach young men, and they really are floundering to find their way. They live in a culture that effectively, for lack of a better way of putting it, tends to put them down, and has robbed them of what men used to see as very much their purpose. Now that can't be their purpose anymore. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can speak a little bit to that and how mm-hmm. you see the Institute helping in this regard.
Yeah, that's a very complicated question, actually, but you can get to the heart of it if you realize what happened in 1965 and the introduction of the birth control pill. Because what we did in that moment, and the way in which the use of the pill spread like wildfire through college campuses and even the Catholic community, et cetera, what we did right then was tell men they were no longer needed. They're only needed for one thing, just for a sec, and then you can go away. We don't really need you. We cut men out, if you think about it, of the single most important event in every person's life, the creation of another person John Paul II describes that moment, the marital act, as man's participation in the transmission of existence itself. And so the use of contraception is really devastating in so many ways. But I would trace it, at least in its current iteration, to that moment, because prior to the use of the birth control pill, it was a fairly public thing in a certain sense. When you were contracepting, both had to participate in the use of a condom, right? You both had to know that it was going to prevent the conception of a child. But once there was the pill, it was entirely up to the woman whether or not she took it, whether or not she even revealed to the man she had sex with that a child was conceived, what should be done with that child. It was her body, therefore her choice. And gradually since then, men have been told over and over in many different ways that who they are is really not needed. You know, there's all these questions about what does it mean to be a man? It's sort of back to the real here, everybody. You've told men that what they are is something you don't want. A man can't claim to be a protector and a provider. Those tasks, when he says, that's my task, he's told he's a sexist or something, or, you know, or women say, well, I could do that too, you know. And in fact, now what I say is women have fallen into the same trap, really. They're reducing themselves to their productive capacity, and not children, but monetary gain. They become workaholics right alongside the men. Both man and woman have lost their sense of their purpose in the cosmos. And my argument would be that it happened when women lost their place. Now men are losing theirs. So, you know, the crisis of men is a real thing. That fewer men graduate from college. More men die from suicide. There are more men killed on the job than women. They tend to take the most dangerous jobs because only they can do them. There's just so many signs. It's in the literature all over the place. And now finally the public is saying, wait a second, what do we do? What did we do? And if you read those accounts carefully, that's one of a writing piece I'm working on right now. You can see that people are absolutely have no idea what to do, because the territory of what constitutes masculinity has been walled off. The American Psychological Association published guidelines in 2019 for working with boys and men in therapeutic encounters. And in the original version of those guidelines, they referred to traditional masculinity as toxic.
Right. It's sort of an interesting thing. You know, I've given some thought to this. One of the things that's interesting, I find, I don't know if you've seen the research on this, but there seems to be among Gen Z, there has been a surge of conversions to Catholicism. I don't know if you saw that. And it's mostly among men. In fact, for the first time ever, more men are going to church than women, percentage-wise. And politically, men are trending more conservative and women are trending more progressive. So the divide politically between them is even growing. It's all this very interesting stuff. And I think at the bottom of it is that there is this sense in young men that I'm just tired of being told I'm not who I am. Like that there's a sense of them who in them that desires what is authentically masculine and to let that come forward. And so where do they find that? They find that in more traditional religious communities, right? They find that in maybe more conservative political circles. And that's a little bit encouraging insofar as it almost seems like there's this little undercurrent that, you know, young men today have kind of had enough of being told that everything they do is toxic, right? But the danger there is that people like Andrew Tate become popular, which is genuinely toxic masculinity, right? Right? Yeah. Because it's an excess vice, you know, but yet nevertheless, he's got a lot of young men who are attracted to him. And that's also a result of this almost reaction to, you know, anything masculine being toxic, but that's the danger. So I guess the real issue for young men is how can we affirm that instinct, which is good in them about what authentic masculinity is and that desire for it, and channel it in such a way that it's positive and really living out what God has revealed about authentic masculinity and not running to an extreme pole that would literally be toxic. And I don't know if that resonates with anything that you've been looking at or researching.
Oh gosh, yes. You know, it's two things I would say. I'm not sure in what order they go, but one of the things is that women need to, those that are wise, that are seeking their own fullness of being, need to explicitly affirm men when they do things that are manly. For example, on campus, when a young man asks if he can help me carry something, I do not say ever, oh no, I'm fine, I got it. I always accept their help, right? If a man wants to open the door for me, I don't say as some women would, you know, that's okay, I got it myself. You know, women are these days, they think that in order to be human, they've got to do it totally, everything independently. And that's a distortion, okay? So the curious thing, the difficult thing is that we need each other to affirm in each other that which is most human about each other. Yeah. So we need to return to a recognition, women do as a gender, to recognize the nobility that really exists, the noble impulse that exists in men to protect. It's visible all the time. Think about when there's a disaster and men flock to the scene to save people from drowning or from fires, or there's just so many things to say on that. But the thing that cannot be overlooked is that what young men need are older men to guide them. It's actually kind of easy to become a woman in a certain way. My vocation is built into my very body. But a man creates outside of himself in the sexual act and in everything else. And he has to choose. He has to make a choice how he's going to exercise his energy. Towards what end is he going to exercise it? He is naturally ordered toward fatherhood, which means protector and provider. And it seems to me there's a third P there somewhere. But, you know, young men, all men need to be given permission if they need it, and they shouldn't, to band together and you know, not have small group sessions, but to do things together that reinforce who they are.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned something there that made me think. Like this is another interesting point. Like, men are always told that they have to talk about their feelings, right? So like, that's it, yeah? So it's like, okay, so look it, I get it. You know, like, it's not, for example, it's not an unmanly thing to cry. It is perfectly okay for a man to cry. I'm half Italian, I cry very easily. So like,
commercials probably, or movies.
Yeah, right. So it's like, it's not unmanly to cry. It's fine to talk about your feelings, and it's actually really good to do so sometimes. I would argue that when a man talks about his feelings, he's talking generally to another man because he wants advice, not because he just wants to be heard. He actually wants to solve a problem, because that's a very kind of, you might want to say, masculine way of approaching that kind of question. But now everybody has to talk about their feelings all the time. And yet for men, being able to be in control and have mastery over their emotions was essential to them accomplishing their task. Why? They have to go to war. They have to see these difficult things. They've got to be able to not lose it when everything is blowing up, right? And that's an essential part. So like, how can we distinguish between just because a man wants to control his feelings or doesn't always want to talk about them, that doesn't mean that he's being toxically masculine.
Well, let me say that you hit the nail on the head when you said that men will talk about their feelings with other men because they want to solve a problem. They want advice. Women like to just talk about it. Right?
Right. And that's okay. And I know if I try to solve my wife's problems when she's talking to me, she thinks I'm not listening to her.
No, that's right. No, that's absolutely right. That's the whole point. And that's okay too. Men need to learn how to listen. And I would offer that there's a lot of learning to do. Men don't listen. Sorry. But at the same
time,
we
don't even have wine and we're not even bashing. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. No, but you might have beer or whiskey. But anyway, the real point is that women like to explore things. They're oriented toward the person in a very real way. And they want to have a chance to express their inner life, to emote, to be affirmed, to be sympathized with. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Men and women use language differently. There's so many things that are revealing of the feminine psyche versus the masculine psyche. It would be impossible to reduce them to even a list.
Well, perhaps maybe this is a good segue to why you're doing something that might not be seen as something typical, and that is you're really including scientific research in your institute. So like, you know, you figure, oh, well, you know, you're a theologian, you're a philosopher, you're going to go with that angle on the question of man and woman. But no, you're saying in this, we have to also include science, what science has to say. And maybe these are the very kinds of questions where science has something to say, right?
Oh, it's absolutely true. Let me back up just a minute and point out that it needs to be made explicit that our institute is devoted to the study of man and woman, and that it's the first of its kind. There are over 900, close to 1,000 women's studies programs on offer in the world, in the U.S. Maybe there's not one devoted to man, and there's certainly nothing devoted to man and woman. And that's because they must both be understood by each other, et cetera. Okay. But the second thing that differentiates us from any other project, I'd say, is this inclusion of the sciences in our research agenda. And you can just point to one example, maybe two. The neuroscience reveals that men and women's brains are structured differently. Women have more connections between the right and left hemispheres, which ought to tell you something about why it is we can seem to see outside of both corners of our eyes, right? Both physically and otherwise. Women have actually better peripheral vision. Men's brains are more organized front to back. They have tunnel vision sometimes, but that's what it means, makes it possible for them to take that hill, whatever the hill is. So this is just scientific fact. When you look at the way in which the male and female brains work, you see that men are absolutely more inclined toward object orientation. That doesn't just mean they like toy trucks when they're little and big trucks when they're old. It structures the way they look at things. And men can be not necessarily more objective, that wouldn't be the right word, but more impartial. Women are not necessarily more subjective. That would be unfair to them, meaning not quite on the mark, but more personal. So men tend to think in abstractions. Women think in terms of concrete examples in reality. They're both needed. Aristotle's metaphysics begins with the real. The starting place is the concrete, and then moves to understands through a process of abstraction what that means. You can't have a civilization unless you can move back and forth between those two ways of thinking. So there's so much work to be done to make these connections. The biology is clear. No matter what you say, the biologist on our committee, on our research team, says, and I believe him and I've seen his data, you can always determine the sex of the child, even if their genital organs are confused, even if it's unclear for whatever reason. You have to run different tests, but at the heart of everything is the fact that we were created only male and female. There must be some reason for that. And the church's question is, why did God create us male and female? And what are the consequences or implications of that decision? That's really what the Institute is pursuing, those sorts of questions. So that's the hard sciences, but then the social sciences, is it really true that women are paid less than men for equal work? Some people say no. Is it really true that women are forced to select themselves into caring professions? The data seem to indicate no, that these are the myths that get perpetrated in our culture that lead to confusion between man and woman and resentment, right? I say if people like Andrew Tate and the other young men on that side of the equation, they're angry because for reasons they have not yet defined. They're angry at some force that seems to have taken away from them who they are, and they're just fighting to get it back, and they don't care who they have to hurt to get it. And I think if we would start to recognize the existence of a masculine genius, I have experiential evidence, anecdotal evidence, that this has a softening effect quite often. If you say to one of those militant young men, well, I happen to think there is such a thing as a masculine genius. Can I tell you about it? Immediately, they relax. Men need respect and women need love. And until we figure that out and live that way, we'll be at war with each other.
In fact, it's interesting. It just dawned on me. Those are the two words in Ephesians 5. You know,
I know. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
just a little aside. I deal with parents, of course. I teach these young men, and parents come in for like a conference or something like that. Talk about the way men and women's brains work and all that sort of thing in relation. And again, I'm painting with a broad brush. It's generally true. That doesn't mean that there's not an odd situation, which it's not. But the kinds of questions I get asked by parents about their sons indicate something, I think. So the dad is always concerned with, is he being respectful? Is he behaving? Is he working hard? Right? The mom wants to know, is he happy? Is he making friends?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. and it's just like, wow, their concerns are very different, probably because their brains and what they're conceptualizing as far as what is essential for their son is different. But yet it's just also a masculine and feminine way of approaching the question of how their son is doing, right?
Yeah, you know, this is really worth mentioning. Cardinal Angelo Scola, in his book, The Nuptial Mystery, makes the argument that every child needs to be exposed to two fundamental laws if they're to flourish. One of them is the law of gratuity, and the other is the law of exchange. And the mother's task is to be sure the child is introduced to the law of gratuity, which is the law of unconditional love. The child must always and first feel that they are loved, that they will not be abandoned, that they're important, that they're, you know, that cradle of love that becomes the home to the child. The law of exchange is the particular task of the father to introduce to the child. What does that mean? The law of exchange has to do with the fact that nothing is free, that you don't get to bask in the warm glow of your mother's love for your entire life. You have to move out into the world. You have to offer something back to the community for the gift of your own life and for the fact that the community is supporting you when you can't. And from the father, the child learns how to take risks and learns that risks sometimes lead to failure, but that you recover, right? They say if it weren't for moms, kids wouldn't make it past the age of four. But if it weren't for dad, they would never learn to take risks. Anyway, I think that Cardinal Scola is correct about this. And you just gave the evidence of it, right? That a woman has different concerns. She pays attention to different things than the man does. But the thing that needs to be clear to everybody is that both are important. Both laws need to be in play for a person, male or female, to flourish.
That's beautiful. So listen, in conclusion, tell us a little bit more about the Institute. What are the sorts of things that we talked a little bit about the things you're going to be researching. What are some of the things we can look forward to coming out of the Institute as it develops and grows?
Yes. So we do have two aspects to our mission. One is research. So our purpose is to articulate a coherent, robust account of man and woman, one that is philosophically, theologically, scientifically grounded. And we're hard at work at that in our own disciplines, so publications and things like that. But we're not done. That's not the extent of it, because it's of no use to anybody unless it reaches the public. So we have also the public outreach arm of the mission. And we've already had one conference on man and woman in the order of creation. The book from that conference will be out in the fall. And we've had this year, because that was on man and woman, this year we're concentrating on men. So John Bishop, who started The Forge, I don't know if people are familiar with that, it's worth looking into. He came and he spoke about masculinity. Anthony Esselin is speaking on campus in the spring, and he's going to speak about his book. It's called No Apologies, Why the Strength of Men is Essential to Sustaining Civilizations, something like that. Then next year we'll have public events about women. So we will have, in the spring, we're doing a series of webinars that will introduce the Institute, and sort of lay out in three steps the basis of the research agenda, people shouldn't be scared by that word. It's more like, there'll be introductory. Isn't it amazing that God is the author of all truth? Is the general purpose of those three webinars. And then we'll follow up on with things more in depth. We have planned to have certificate programs that people can earn certificates in the study of man and woman or related topics, the family, sex and gender, all the adjacent topics. It's endless, right? One last thing I'll say, so watch for that. We're going to have a social media presence, plan to launch that in the spring. And then eventually, maybe in a couple years, we definitely plan to have educational materials suitable for K-12.
Oh, wow. Great.
Because
how about that?
Sex education should be preceded by personhood education. Otherwise, the child concludes that sex is just a biological function disconnected from who they are. And that would be a mistake. So we want to be sure that we introduce to children much earlier some of these realities, or at least the questions. What does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to be a man?
Wonderful. Dr. Savage, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast and just being able to have the opportunity to talk with you, which I always enjoy. How exciting. I mean, a one-of-a-kind institute, an institute on the study of man and woman that's going to include not only theological, philosophical, but scientific, both hard sciences and social sciences included in the conversation. I mean, this just sounds wonderful. And I think everybody can agree, so needed today for the sake of really our civilization, to tell you the truth.
Oh, that's right. And I guess I have to make a plug. It could only have happened at Franciscan. Because Franciscan is really the university under the wonderful leadership of Father Dave Pavanka is absolutely intent on doing just that, on somehow recovering the culture of life and the culture, Western civilization, or, you know, that, I don't want to be too dramatic, but clearly it's under attack and there needs to be a coordinated effort to respond adequately to that. Yeah.
That's lovely. And we are grateful for Franciscan University.
Yeah.
We've had the great opportunity of doing some work together with Franciscan, and it's always been a grace. And we're happy to be involved in promoting this institute.
Yeah, you are. You have been. Thank you so much for your support.
You're very welcome. Well, Dr. Savage, God bless you. We'll be praying for you. Please pray for us, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right, peace.
In addition to producing this podcast, A Ray of Hope is also known for producing events such as retreats, missions, conferences, and concerts. If you'd like to learn more about what we offer, just go to our website and click on Experience. There you can see and learn all the various programs that we offer. God bless you, and we hope to see you soon.